It is the Rhetoric Warriors podcast, once again, circling back to protect the world from words or vice versa. I don't know. I am Dr. Dan. I am a rhetorician, late night comedy writer, founder of Rhetoric Warriors, trying to teach the people a little bit better skills, or a whole lot better skills in the time of broken politics. Trump came along and broke the pinata. And now everybody's like, what do we do with this crazy candy? So we're trying to learn a little bit more. Here on the podcast, I teach people, I interview academics and persuasion professionals to do some education. I also interview comedians about their politics, because that's always interesting to me. And I convert people. I will have people on here from whatever perspective they want to take, and I will lead them away from it like a weird shepherd moving a goat around or something. I don't know. So this week we have another example of I'm going to put you into the rhetoric files. Like, you're a rhetorician, right? So my guest today is a rhetorician, messaging professional from the other side of the aisle. You can get rhetoric training in English departments, or what I did, which was speech departments. And we're going to talk about some of the differences today, or the similarities. She's a senior instructor at Colorado State. She has her own consulting education firm, Appendance, where she teaches everyone the power of excellence in business writing. Dr. Jenny Morse.
Yeah, thank you.
Yes. How's it going? You have way more light than I do. I'm like in the half light, so the light is bouncing off of me, and I look like a Magneto or something.
Yeah. Well, I have these floor to ceiling windows in the back, and the shades that are on them are very pretty, but do not help with the light very much. So,
but it's good. Like, you're like, I mean, it's better to have more than less.
And I'm, yeah, you can see me, but I can see outside. It looks like I'm in the sun.
Yeah, it looks like you're in heaven. It looks like you're bathed in the white.
Just visiting to talk about words.
Sure. You know, that's what rhetoricians do. We spend most of our time in heaven and then just come down to earth to play word games.
Only when people make us angry, right?
Yeah, when they need thunderbolts of words thrown at them and all that good stuff. So we were going to do this a while back, but you were traipsing around Spain.
I was. My family likes to travel. My mom is they're just retired from being a high school Spanish teacher. And Spain was one of the first places that opened briefly. And so we took a family trip to Spain. While we were there, the Delta virus started growing. So we wore our masks everywhere that we went. And, you know, but we were mostly at the beach playing. It was lovely.
That sounds lovely. We went to Spain and played on the beach together as a family. That sounds like a children's book or something.
Yeah. Well, so one of the beaches that we went to turned out to be one of the places where Game of Thrones was filmed. So we were walking around this gorgeous beach with this huge old fortress castle, just like, you know, this is awesome. And then there are these posters that are like, this scene was filmed right here. And then you can walk around.
Interesting. Huh.
It was fun.
I guess it's a children's book. It's Game of Thrones, unless it gets in M. Night Shyamalan's hands, and then it becomes a horror film.
Yeah. No, we didn't have any of that. It was very positive, happy, lovely.
You didn't age, so you're good.
Yep.
All right, solid. So introduce yourself a little bit to everybody. Let us, you know, give a little bit of background.
Yeah. So I came in, let's see, I got to rhetoric through poetry and creative writing. So I have 3 degrees in English, and 2 of them are creative writing focused. I like to joke about my doctorate. I mean, as we do, PhDs.
Oh yeah, it's hilarious.
Yes. So I was at a presentation yesterday where they were asking, they were doing a medical device presentation. Is anybody in the room a doctor? And I'm like, yeah. My friend is like, put your hand down. And I'm like, I am. I'm a doctor of poetry.
Yes.
If there are any language emergencies, I can take care of them.
I totally agree. Like, we're there for all the linguistic breakdowns in the world. We will band-aid those and set broken bones of words. And that's what we do.
Totally. And the person was trying to get feedback on their pitch. So I'm like, my doctorate is relevant to their presentation. And they did not specify medical doctor.
Well, and I used to tell people, like, you know, they would challenge when they challenged my credibility on something, like, because my degrees are language degrees, they're not science or anything like that. I'm like, well, so I can't talk about science if I don't have a science degree, but you're using language right now and you have no PhD. So I think you should just shut up because you don't know what you're doing with that technology.
Right. Back out of our area, right?
Yeah, for sure.
Yes. So I was poet, creative writer, and sort of accidentally found myself in the business school at Colorado State University. You know, it was one of those, like, a job comes through, you apply for it, and it just worked out. That was about 8 years ago now. And I had been doing some freelance writing stuff on the side, like ghostwriting, grant writing, things like that, that made me qualified for the job. But once I started doing it, I teach business writing now. I have for 8 years.
Who became the business.
Yes.
Instructor.
And I have my own, you know, consulting company, going into companies and training employees and how to improve their communication, mostly their emails, how to make them more productive. So how can, like, what kind of writing habits can you build in order to be faster and more efficient? So a lot of things, just like, we know that brains are not super good at proofreading our own work, right? So when you, once you see a phrase, if you see it again, your brain sort of shortcuts and doesn't show you if there are any errors in it. So I talk about that with the employees and just go, like, you can't read your own work. You can't proofread your own work. So what are some strategies we can come up with, or, you know, that we can put into your habit to improve what the output, so that you're not sending mistakes to people? So, like, how can we use autocorrect effectively? How can we use a tool like Grammarly? How can we get people in the office, you know, to double check our work? How can we just save a draft, get up and walk away from it and come back to it later, which is really what I want them to do. So I sort of integrate a lot of the things that I learned as a writer, just the habits of writing, into the training, as well as talking about specific strategies. So the thing that I love is I get to talk about language. Like, this is a poet's dream, right? I get to talk about word choice, language, grammar, like how you put words in place in order to create certain effects. And I'm doing it in a way that is practical for the people that I'm teaching. So it's like, okay, if you start every sentence with I, your message is going to sound self-centered. And they're like, ooh, I've never thought about that. I mean, people's mind, I'm like, when you start a sentence with, I was wondering if, you have not asked a question. And people are like, oh my gosh, this is why people never answer my questions. Because I'm not actually asking them anything. So it's really
fun. Is interesting, right? Like, how little most people of close attention they pay to language. Yes. Like, it's a technology they use, but they don't step back and inspect it. They just are driven by what they've kind of learned and what they've adopted. It's not like they have that kind of disciplined professional control over it.
No. And we talk about, like, there's a huge difference in speaking and writing too. So if you say, I was wondering if you could help me with this, you're going to stop at the end of that sentence. You're going to put a pause there. And the other person knows from that pause, you're not speaking. So they're supposed to speak. Right. So the question becomes asked in the space of it, right? When we're talking face to face, like, that's how the conversation works. But in writing, there is no pause. So when you say, I was wondering if you could help me with this, were you just, like, bringing that up as a thought that you're having? Did you actually want me to help? Do you want, I don't know how that's coming up. So you have to train yourself to use a question mark.
Yeah, writing loses so many of the meta cue tools, you know, that speech has, that there's so many things you can do to add in meta instructions on how to decode this message with your head movements and your, you know, voice and everything. And it's like emojis, you know, when emojis jumped up in text, it's like, oh, these are awesome because you need this for this speed writing that isn't going to use the traditional grammar punctuation, even the, you know, the guidelines of that. So, like, the emojis, like, yeah, okay. So, you know, I'm being funny here. Just
yes. It's like, okay, so I'm going to write this, but since you can't hear me or see me, instead of a period, here's a picture of my face. Yeah, I love talking about emojis. I do professional writing. So in most of the arena that I'm working in, emojis are still considered not acceptable. And we talk about that because I do think they are allowed after you have an established relationship with someone, right? So what we see is not being professional about them is that I don't know how you're going to take it if I've never met you before, I haven't interacted with you before. That still isn't going to help our interpretation. We need to maintain a sort of formal level of interaction, complete sentences and things, until we have an understanding of each other so that we can move to that tool. I think we'll get to a place pretty quickly, like 10, 20 years, where emojis are going to be more of a standard. I just think our expectations are like, they are useful. They're such a useful invention.
Yeah.
To do this that we're talking about, like speaking has all of these signals and writing doesn't. And I go through this with a lot of my clients. We talk through all of the things that you get from somebody's face and body and their voice. Your voice has like, I don't know, 12 different qualities, right? So that's evidence in addition to the words. Writing has three, I think. It has words, it has punctuation, it has arrangement in space. So when you think about like all of the cues you get from speaking and then you distill that to writing, you've got three tools. It's such a challenge to communicate anything effectively in writing.
Yeah, no, it is. I think, again, this sort of hyper understanding of language within mediums like this that you get when you work professionally in it and you work in it academically and for a long time, like in the lessons you've learned from poetry, like the super sensitivity to a word, right? The ability to feel a word, you know, that's never taught to business writers. And you come in, you're like, well, you know, what makes a really effective piece of written communication is that you create these words in the way that they carry an experience to people. And as opposed to I dominate these words and I give out information, I'm like, well, good luck with that.
Right. No, you're always crafting an idea and you're using language to craft the way that that idea enters someone else's mind, right? So every word and the placement of every word is building the picture that the other person is going to hold. And a lot of what I focus on is that the picture is also the relationship, so that every message that you're sending is either building trust with that person or reducing trust with that person. And that's a lot of the outcome that the companies are looking for, is they want their employees to be able to build trust with their colleagues, with their, you know, superiors, with clients, with other companies. So what are the strategies that help us build trust and what should we be careful of? And this is why things like emojis, it's like as soon as somebody else uses an emoji with you, that is it's okay now. But until they do, you should not, right? And so just like outlining some of those rules that I think we acquire through our lifetime of experience, right? You just acculturate two things, like learning to shake hands and when you should hug people. And I do those examples all the time because people are really familiar. Like when you meet somebody for the first time pre-COVID, we would shake their hand. I don't know what we're going to do now. And I talk about how culturally handshaking is actually defining your personal space as well. So like by putting your arm out, you establish like this is the distance that you're allowed to come to the end of my arm into my personal space. But when I hug somebody, I actually bring them into my personal space. And for Western culture, right? Like we're not going to bring people into our personal space until we know and are comfortable with them. So if that's something that we automatically do without thinking about it, what are the parallels that we have in writing for that? Well, it's like the difference between saying, dear Mr. French, right? And like, hey, Dr. Dan.
Right. Yeah. No, that's why, like, when I shake people's hands, I do it like this.
Just a short arm. You want them as close to you as possible.
It's like a shake hug. It's like,
come on in.
When I would teach interpersonal communication, it was so much fun to mess with those cultural mores, you know, all the normative habits. I would tell people, like, go out and shake somebody's hand and keep your fingers spread.
Yeah.
And just,
and they don't know what to
do. Any variation throws people off so hard. Like, go side to side when you shake instead of up and down. Because there's no, how did it become this?
Right.
And is it two or three? Is it, if you just hold on, if you just don't let go? And people are so sensitive to it, it just kind of breaks open, you know.
Because all of those things tell us information about people, like information that I think is subconscious, right? Or like low conscious. One of the most obvious with a handshake is just people talk about like a firm handshake. And that's a conversation that we have. It's like a firm handshake is something that we're using to tell if you are confident or not. And then what I like to talk about is how all of this is like what you're doing by messing with it is the same thing that I talk about. This is all not real, right? Like the amount that you grip someone's hand in a handshake does not tell you anything about whether you can trust that person or not. It's a proxy. It's a way of like shorthanding a signal, but that means that people can learn to give a handshake that is going to build trust.
Right. Even if they're untrustworthy people.
Manipulation.
Yeah. Untrustworthy people can give a very trustworthy handshake.
Yes. So you can perform trust in certain ways, which is where we have to talk about, like, are you doing that for the good of the other person or for the benefit of yourself?
Yeah. Again, like you said, so the first week of your class is basically convincing people it's valuable to learn all this stuff. You know, when people come into communication classes or even they find out, you know, that I have a PhD, you know, directly labeled rhetoric, you know, they're like, what do you do with that? And I'm like, I do everything I want to with that.
All of language is in my purview. Yeah.
So it is fascinating, though, that once you've studied this stuff for so long, it becomes so immersed in it and becomes like, well, of course, you have to really understand language as a human being to be effective in the world. And then you realize, oh, yeah, we're like the 1% of people that are doing this.
Because we're like, how can we be like this small group of people who just go, isn't it crazy that there is a massive difference between saying that something is good and something is beneficial? Right? Like that creates a different perspective. And it's like, oh, I want to think about that for a little while. And other people are like, they're synonyms. Can we just move on?
Right. Let's just move on. Let's act as if this stuff isn't magic, which it is. It doesn't actually
change things happening in your head through the language that I use. Think about the power and control.
No, it's, it wasn't too long, especially into my graduate degree, where I was walking down a hallway. I think it was the first time I visited the department, and somebody, the professor, had a bunch of books out that they were giving away, just shedding books. And I grabbed one on persuasion and something about, you know, some kind of collection of essays about persuasion or summaries of research over the last couple of years. And I'm just like, oh my God, people study this? Like, this is amazing. Like, I want to know like every single thing you can do within these technologies to move people around. Mm-hmm. And I can't imagine other people not being fascinated by that.
No, and I think also to then you start to become aware of how they're being used on you and like which ones you fall for and which ones you don't. I was talking to somebody yesterday who brought up like, oh, one of my undergraduates, I was saying like, why did you take this class, something, something? And they're like, oh, my friend had you for a professor last semester. And so they told me to take this class with you. I'm like, okay, that's great. There are four people who teach this class. How do you know that I'm the best one? And he's like, well, my friend said that you're the best one. Well, your friend only had me for a teacher and didn't have the other three. So how does he know? Like, well, he liked you. Great. I mean, that's good, but that doesn't tell you that I'm the best instructor. Like, you don't actually have any evidence of that. So then I was like, and so this is social proof. And this is going to come up in chapter 8 of our textbook. And I want you to remember this. What you have as evidence is not evidence. And they're like, oh, I guess you're right. I just did do what my friend told me to do without thinking about it. Of course, then they brought up Rate My Professor and they're like, well, we all check your Rate My Professor and it's fine. You're okay. So.
Yeah. I don't know. Like the more I've gotten into politics and working within this space lately, the crazier it seems whenever somebody has a political discussion or a truth discussion or puts their beliefs out there at all. Cause I'm just like, you are not qualified to believe anything or to state your own beliefs.
Yeah.
You are clearly unqualified to be a believer in anything. And so the second book that I've been working on is Why America Can't Think. Mm-hmm. And it's just that like what you just did, giving him some baby training really quick into what social proof is. People have never heard that term.
No.
They've never really been trained in logic. And if they have, they've lost it all. They don't hold on to the mechanisms of evidence. Like if you ever look at the court, like pull up, sometime do a search on courtroom evidence. And it's like 12 pages of what evidence actually is and why it's acceptable or not acceptable. And that's in courts where they still get things wrong.
Yeah.
So people saying things like using the technology, like, oh yeah, this is easy. I just bang, 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 bang.
Right. Well, I did it. So that means, you know, it works for everybody. You're like, no.
That probably leads to bad thoughts.
Yeah. Yes. So then the social proof conversation, of course, turns into their 18, 19, 20 for the most part, these undergraduates. Well, I always do exactly the opposite of what my friends do. And I'm like, okay, I know you feel that way. You're a teenager, like this is important. Let's just look around the room and point out everyone who's wearing the same clothing. You're like, all right, let's just, if you're wearing jeans and t-shirt, please stand up, you know? And they're like, oh shoot, you know, we all look exactly the same. Yes, yes, you do. I know those are your clothes, but you're dressing to fit into a larger group. Yeah. So I think we also try to talk ourselves out of a lot of the things that, like, you read about it in a book, right? You grab this book on persuasion and you're reading about it. Isn't this fascinating? And then there's this, because I learned it, now I can see it, but I can also see when I'm being convinced by it. Like, you know, I'll be looking at something on Facebook and be like, oh, I need that. And then I'm like, oh, they totally use that sale discount thing on me. And yeah, I'm still going to get it.
No, there is no impervious space to live outside of influence. I like being influenced. Like, I tell my kids that they're 20-year rhetoric experiments. You know, I purposefully raise them according to rhetorical principles.
Yeah.
About dialogue and choice and working your way reasonably towards things. And I also built in there that they get to persuade me. Like, ooh. I'm very persuadable. Like, I'm like, just tell me why you want this and I'll listen and I'll, you know, go along. And so they've learned that. They come to me and they actually persuade me. But it's that sense of being open to persuasion, which then gives me permission to go in and persuade them as well, because we're trading the rights to do that back and forth.
You're seeing who can make the best argument.
Yeah, kind of. And it's not always even an argument. I'm like, persuasion. The fun part of it, when you really get into it, is just how much of it is outside of rationality. And I told the kids, like, who's going to be better at complimenting me? Like, whoever compliments me better is going to get the extra piece of pie.
Right, right. And it has to be smooth. So I fall for it, not the obvious.
I'm like, and they would say something. I'm like, I don't feel complimented. You don't, that's not a real compliment. Mm-hmm. Think of me, what you know about me and what I value in the world, you know, and see if you can offer that, you know, as a compliment somehow. And you can just see their gears going, okay, what could I, And it's, you know, it's training, like giving people compliments is a super skill in the world. If you can do it well and authentically, people love it.
Yeah, people like you. Your thing reminded me, my dad's a lawyer. And growing up, he's not a rhetorician in the same way, right? But there's this way in which, like, make your argument, make your case, present your evidence, and we'll think about it. And I always knew that I had won the argument when he said, "That's it. You're just doing it this way because I'm your father." And I'm like, yep, that's where I won, but I still have to do what he said, you know, because there was no argument. Like,
that's the problem with lawyers. They eventually go back to power. Yeah. You know, yeah. Like if you win, you win. If my kids out argued me about something they won, great. You get it.
Yeah. Uh-huh. I wish we had had that, but no, it was like, well, I concede the argument, but I'm still in charge. My house, my rules. You're like, I totally got him.
No. See, that's unethical persuasion right there. You don't get to retain all the choice decision power at the end. Like they have to, if they win, they win.
I don't know. It was the same, similar kind of training. I turned out to be really good at making arguments and cases and persuading.
And expecting people not to win, even when you win.
You've been but now I have all the power. I'm like, I'm 100% in control. I'm a professor in a classroom. Like, here's the syllabus, follow it.
It is a control freak game. It's like stand-up. I tell everybody, they ask me why I do stand-up instead of like improv or sketch or things like that. I'm like, I don't want to work with other people. Stand-up is a control freaks game. Like I am in control of everyone in this room.
Yeah.
Every word that gets uttered is because I have chosen it.
Yes. Yeah. I think being a professor is kind of like that kind, that performance. Not just a professor, but training at the companies as well. I do like 8-hour seminar sessions for 25 employees. And I've been doing them for 6 years. So now it feels like a stand-up routine.
Sure.
Because I'm teaching the same content. It's an 8-hour show that I do, right? It's an interactive show. They participate in it, but I have all the jokes and all the timing and all the, everything's already set. So that it really feels like this is a performance that I have mastered because I've done it 100 times. And so I just show up and it's like, oh, you're 25 new people here for me to entertain with my set.
Yeah. It's just an acting exercise, right? You've got the script, you know how it goes, new audience. So here's the matinee show. Here we go.
And I think the acting piece is really, you would think it's your own enthusiasm, right? Like because you do the performance so many times, you must get bored. But I mean, every time I talk to people about like the wordplay, it's like, no, do you understand how incredible this is? I use the same example and I'm still blown away by this example on time 101 that I'm telling you about it.
Yeah, so you're in the right thing. You've chosen the right profession. You can stay interested without effort.
No, yeah, every single time it's like, this is so cool.
Yeah, I taught comedy defensive driving for a couple of years back when it was a viable thing to do here in Texas. And it's a 6-hour course and they mandate exactly what the curriculum has to be. But I loved it because within that curriculum, there's so much dialogue you get to do, like gathering examples from them and places to turn into comedy. It was the exact same thing. I knew exactly what was going to happen every time, but it was always some crazy new people, you know, and like you let those people into your script.
Yes.
I know where it's going, but you're all going to come in and inhabit this with me. Uh-huh. That's why I like doing crowd work so much in stand-up, because you don't know where it's going to go. And these insane humans that just wandered into your space suddenly pop up with some kind of information. You're like, what?
Yes. And that's part of the fun too, is then, okay, so you've set up the joke, like the joke or the scene, or in my case, like the lesson, right? I've set it up. I know where it's going, but then I ask the question and I'm expecting a range of responses. And then this person comes in and you're like, oh, I have never had that one before. That's such a cool, interesting, like, okay, let's not get distracted. Let's integrate that into the so we can still get here. But yes, humans surprise you every single time. And I think that's what makes the teaching part fun, right, is you have the built-in script, but it is going to be different, a different experience with every audience.
Well, especially if you dictate the space and permission to do that. Like if you come in with enthusiasm and creativity, then they know they've got permission to say this crazy thing that they just thought, and they will. And then yeah. Like the whole world in that little space for a few minutes explodes and everybody's like, oh my God, did they just say that?
Yeah. It's really fun. And then to have it all for me being something that's useful to them so that ultimately when they leave, not only was it like the experience was mildly entertaining, they learned some stuff, but they're going to go and they're going to be able to apply it immediately. So it wasn't like a waste of time, right? It's not over. It's now something that you have tools that you can implement that are going to make you a more effective communicator right now. And I really enjoy that part too.
So talk about the approach to writing these days, because it used to be, you know, universities especially were the beneficiary, the recipients of really good writing training all the way from first grade up through high school. It was the core skill that people learned in schools, you know, that kind of literary based education. And now it's not like people are not going outside, and it's more of a rarity for people to really enjoy reading and writing. So you're downstream of all this now. In fact, kind of, you are the weird stopping point of now. Suddenly you're like, oh no, you did need to learn how to write.
Yes. I think that somehow the education system has what you're talking about. Like somehow we've gotten to where like literacy is the goal instead of language as a tool, right? So as soon as you can read, people are like, that's you'll be
I
fine.
I can read. Yeah. I'm done.
And that's what I start with the undergraduates when we're talking about why are you required to take this class? I'm like, you can read and write. So why would the people who run the institution force you to take this class? What do they think that you can get out of it? And they have to hypothesize, right? And so we think for a long time, like, why would they make you do this? I do think that a huge factor in our writing skills, and I'm not sure we can blame this on education just so much as like, this is the life that we're living. People aren't reading. And I think that those of us who are in doing rhetoric, doing writing, like, why did we get into this field? Most of us loved to read. Whether you're like one of my friends who loves to read the same things over and over, or like me, I think like, I want to try to read everything in the world before I die. This is an impossible goal, but that's the goal. Read as much as I can of everything. But we're all readers. And in some ways, the things that we learned about writing were simply because when we're reading, our brain was organizing language, right? And so the more you put in, the more you knew. And now what I struggle with is that most of the people that I'm working with are not readers. So their sense of language is really limited to its efficacy and not the like play and the way you can shape it and all the things that I think are cool. They're like, well, I just said, you know, we have to go to the store. Why do I need to think of 12 different ways that I could frame that idea? And you're like, because every one of them is going to send different signals about who you are and what you want and why you want it and how you're going to get it. We're just not, reading is no longer a foundation of our culture. And therefore, writing is no longer a foundation of our culture.
Yeah, the stuntedness that happens with humans when they move across other mediums. Like my son grew up on video games.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was 5 years old. He didn't have the dexterity to move the video games, but he was interested in them. So he would sit on my lap. I remember the game. In fact, he went back and found it recently. It was a Batman game where Batman was running and fighting things and leaping off buildings. And I would move the thumbs for him, so that he could have the experience of being in that world.
Yeah.
And he's loved it ever since. And he's just got a job as a editor with a big gaming company.
Cool.
And he's so fluent in that world. He plays a game called Rocket League that is Formula One cars playing soccer in space in this weird arena. And it's just disorienting. It's constantly moving and changing angles.
Yeah.
It's literally dizzying for me to watch it, but he's completely proficient in it, knows every single tiny thing about that game. And his literacy has moved over there. Mm-hmm. And it's a high proficiency literacy.
Yeah.
How are you going to use that to educate outside of that game? It doesn't universalize itself outside of those games the way reading does, because then it filters into how you talk and how you think. Because it sounds like a lot of what you're doing, especially with your undergrads, and I know most people do this, you realize very quickly you're a thinking teacher.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because they can't write if they can't think about it first. So you're doing logic and thought instruction.
And a lot of separating evidence from judgment, right? So like a thing that humans tend to do is we come to conclusions very fast. And I need them to think about what are those conclusions based on? And so like backtrack. I used to do this exercise where I had a bag of objects and they had to reach into the bag and feel an object. And I'm like, okay, tell me what it is. And they would tell you, and it'd be like a keychain, you know, and they'd say it's a keychain. And I'm like, you don't know that. Tell me what you're touching. Tell me what you feel. Tell me what evidence your hand is collecting that leads you to the conclusion that it's a keychain. And they'd be like, what are you talking about? I'm like, well, what's a keychain made out of? How do you know that the thing you're touching is metal? Describe that to me. And then they're like, well, it's smooth, but it has a shape. I know it's metal because it's cold when I touch it and then it heats up. I'm like, yes, those are the things that your brain is taking in and connecting to an object that you have in your experience. That's the work that we're doing in writing. It's not just, I trust you or I don't trust you. It's how do we get there so that we can control the judgment on the other end and control in the best possible way.
Why is it that word has become such a devil term? Like I tell people, so again, my thing recently has been to take all the information, especially when I get interested in something, and to translate it over into stand-up comedy. Like how can you do a course that also is a comedy club routine to the level of comedy in stand-up and professional stand-up? You're supposed to get a laugh, like a real laugh, not a humorous chuckle. Like they cannot stop themselves from laughing every 7 seconds. So the script, the demands on the script become so high that when you move over into that kind of writing, you're like, every single word has to be placed perfectly and chosen correctly to get that response. And so I bring people over there and I'll get interested in something. Like I get interested in the Titanic. I'm like, okay, I bet you I could write an hour show on things you don't know about the Titanic. Like, did we talk about this before? I feel like I've asked you this.
No.
How many Adolfs do you think died on the Titanic?
How many Adolfs?
Adolfs.
Like men named Adolf?
Yeah, there were over 2,000 people died, I think.
I don't know, 8?
There were 4 Adolfs on the register of the Titanic that died, that drowned on the Titanic. How many do you think would be around now? 0, right? There are no more Adolfs. You can't name a kid Adolf.
No.
But this was 1912, so it was still pre-Adolf.
Yeah, I mean, that was a pretty common name for Europeans. I mean, mostly Germans.
So when you take stuff like that and you're like, okay, if you're thinking your way back through all this stuff and you're pulling up a word or a name and you're like, let's really investigate that and see everything that's embedded in it.
Yeah.
Like I could do probably 10 minutes on just Adolf, just the name. What if you named your dog Adolf?
Yeah.
Every time you go to the dog park, Adolf.
And you're not allowed to do that. But then you can link it to the weirdness of other famous names that you're not allowed or are allowed to do, like having just been in Spain, right? The connection to there are lots of Spanish people named Jesus and Maria, like, but our American culture is like, wait, you're not allowed to, those names are taken,
right?
Not Mary, but Jesus. You know, like you couldn't call a kid Jesus, not in America, right?
So yeah, especially his middle name was H, some kind of H name, some Jesus Harvey right. Turner. Yeah,
right. You can't. So similar, but it's like it's also cultural. I think the Adolf one does a good job of like crossing culture, and nobody's going to do that
around the world.
Yeah,
like it's worldwide now. Mm-hmm. Like you can't, like in Nigeria, you can't name your kid Adolf.
No, not unless you, you know, don't like them very much.
Well, and as you do for me, like I get super fascinated in the deep research because I know I can pull it out as an interesting fact thing and then jam it into stand up. And like, there was somebody that was sued for naming their kid Adolf a few years back. I can't remember what culture it was. But they named their kid Adolf and they sued to change his name. The kid wasn't old enough to sue. They're like, no, you can't be named Adolf. The kid didn't know.
Another family member did?
I don't remember. Maybe it was the community or something. I have to look up the story to actually get it down. So taking cool stuff like that, transferring it into another medium like spoken or stand up or education or writing. Like I remember when I learned that you could do interesting writing. Like I was reading Kurt Vonnegut, Breakfast of Champions.
Yeah.
And he kept beginning sentences with and, a capital and.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, they told me I can't do that.
They lied.
But it's cool. And I like that he's doing it. And I immediately started doing it. And I've done it ever since.
I do it too. I love starting sentences with and I love starting sentences with but. And I talk to people about how doing that, I think, is a sort of like speech habit carryover. But it's also a way of highlighting or emphasizing like, oh, I'm connecting an idea or I'm transitioning to a new idea. And I want that to stand out in your mind. So I've started the sentence this way. And when people say you're not allowed to do that, I'm like, you've always been allowed to do it as long as it's a complete sentence. Your teachers, like your parents, lie to you for your own good. And when you are an adult, they're like, sorry, you know, we lied to you that the park was closed on Saturdays because we were lazy and didn't want to go. That's not true. The park is always open. You can go whenever you want.
That's funny. I used to tell my kids when they would talk about profanity, they used to always get on me about using too much profanity. And I'm like, they'd be like, that's a bad word. I'm like, no, that's a great word. I said, just, you're talking to people who are not good at using it. Like,
yeah.
I'm a professional comedian. I have a license to use that word. And they're like, is that a real thing? I'm like, yeah, it is.
Yeah. There's a bunch of super cool books about swearing that I've read recently, about how swearing in the professional world can create in-groups. Right. So people who use the same slang, but like use the same swears that we use it for emphasis, that swearing in our brains actually happens in two different areas. When we swear in response to pain, that happens in a different part of your brain than when you swear for rhetorical purpose, which is fascinating. Like the swear actually comes from a different part of your brain when you stub your toe than when you're like doing it for emphasis.
Yeah.
Yeah. So many cool language is just cool.
Right. People should know that. That's what they get when they wander into a pen dance. Tell me about that name. How'd you come up with that name?
So a pendance, it's my brother is like, it always sounds like appendix. I wish you had picked something different, but a pendance means to add to in writing. And I named my company when I was doing freelance projects. I mean, it wasn't the company it is now, but that's the name I came up with. I had a website, I owned it already. So I was doing freelance editing for the most part, writing and editing. And it felt very much like I was a support for other people. So to add to in writing felt really positive. And then I liked that the word, right, is a pen dance with an extra P. So it was also like, that's pretty and fun and explains a lot, but it has an unusual rhythmic pattern. So it's a pendant, which makes it hard to say. And everyone's like, change it. Cause you know, you want your name to be recognizable. And I'm like, no, I'm never going to be that big. So it won't matter.
Yeah, naming's fascinating. I've done a bunch of naming for our marketing agency here in Austin, and it's fascinating. I charge a lot of money to work on people's names. I'm going to have to think about this.
So I've done it for a couple of clients on the side, and I can never figure out how much to charge them, because like most of it is just wandering around thinking, how do I charge people for the time? Like I'm at the grocery store, just imagining different names for you and how they would work.
Yeah, how do you but feel? Because like my partner is a hardcore business guy, right? So he's in sales and he wants to overcharge for everything. And I've been in academics and entertainment, so I tend to underprice everything because I'm like, well, I got to get the work, right? You can't let these people go. Right. So we kind of sit in the middle. I think the last thing we did was like $12,000 to rename a company.
Nice. You know,
which is
so you just pick a number. Because that's, I think part of my problem is I'm always trying to tell the client how I justify the number.
Yeah.
So like some projects I charge by word, some I charge by hour, depending on the project. And for naming, it's like.
Well, they do need to see that they're buying something. They can't just buy your mental wanderings. I used to tell them you're buying my insomnia time. Like if I wake up at 3 a.m, can't get back to sleep, I'll think about your stuff.
Yeah.
And that's what you're really buying, mental real estate, which I don't want to think about your stuff. You know, you're going to have to convince me with money to think about your stuff.
Yeah, to spend time doing it. No, that's interesting. It is your insomnia time. It's like, oh, got distracted, wandered over here into all the possibilities. Yeah.
Well, it's also like I built, because business can't deal with the ethereal, especially in creative, I had to build a process. I'm like, it's a 6-week process. You're going to get 10 name options. Here's the schedule. Here are the exercises I do to create names, because doing it with recognition versus just pure ether recall. Like if you write a list of names that are possibles, then you find synonyms and antonyms.
Yep.
Then it just sort of becomes an exercise. And I've probably got 10, 15 of those that I use. So it looks like they're buying something. Like I'm taking you through this and you're gonna get 10 options, you own them all, and you have to choose from those 10. And they like that they get involved in the process and they feel like they chose it.
I think that's the win. You're right. You sell the process instead of selling time or words. If I get asked to do it again, right now I get asked to help on they're like translation projects, but not exactly. So my brother works with some companies in Asia, and then he's like, oh, I know this writer. She'll handle everything for you. So I get these websites that are, you know, Japanese, Chinese, Korean, Thai, whatever, that has been Google translated into English, because I don't speak those languages. And then I have to make them make sense. And I had one where I open up the website that I'm supposed to work on, and the very first thing, the slogan, is everything is for the people's health. And I stared at that sentence for 2 weeks. That was my insomnia time. I'm like, I know what this says, but no. Everything. And I was wandering around saying it to people. I'm like, everything is for the people's health. What does that feel like it might say in English?
That does sound like Chairman Mao, though. It does, that kind of big universal positive claim.
Yes, but you can't leave that on a website and sell it to Americans.
No. Everything we do is for you.
I forget what we changed it to. It went through like 3 cycles. Like what you're talking about, I would run through things and say like, what do you think about this? How does this feel to you? And then they come back, oh, you know, we want it to be more like this, more like that, have this, and then run through it again. Which is fun. Again, it's the poetry creative writer. Like I'm playing with the words, trying to get the sense of the thing that we want to have out for the public to experience.
Yeah. And I like all that too. I don't like to have them in my process is the problem. Like that's why I give them decision points. Like here's the decision meetings. And I do an initial gather so I can kind of hear all their thoughts. And then I'm like, I never want to hear from you again because you will ruin my creativity. you know, and I may come up with three that are way out there and like, I really like them, but you won't use them. That's fine. You've got other options. But if I have to start really censoring myself and my internal weirdness to you, you're not going to get a good product.
Yeah.
So I can't usually keep them out of my process.
I keep them out, but then I say, like, I want you to look at this and tell me what you think so that I can feel it out.
Ooh, so it's very skin crawl to hear what they think.
It's very, but like, I've done this much. Let's see if this is on the right track.
I've tried that, but it does. Yeah. It doesn't yield, like, involving non-creative people in the creative process. I don't mind them being the decision makers at the end.
Yeah. But you also are giving them 10 options. And when I'm doing the website, like, I'm going to do this website. And when I get to the end of the website, we're done. I'm not going back and redoing the website because you had an idea. So I need to start working on it and see if it matches their expectation. Because if I'm going to keep translating all of this stuff, I mean, it was a website that was like 8,000 words.
Yeah, that's crazy.
I mean, yeah, no, they don't sign off on every word. It's just like the very beginning. Is this about what you're looking for? Does this match the tone of your company in your language?
When I'm used to working in Hollywood, where you, every time you open up to somebody with power's input, it warps the rest of the creative.
Yes.
And suddenly you're constantly, your ship is constantly listening because they keep blowing holes in it. You're like, you're so lucky if it ever gets to port, you know, or out to sea where it's like, oh, this is viable now. Yeah. Because they've blown holes. Like, I remember I had a buddy who wrote for Everybody Loves Raymond, and he was good friends with Raymond. And so he was there from the very beginning. And he showed me the original pilot that they shot for the series. And originally they had kids with brown hair because both the parents had brown hair. And the advertisers that were underwriting it said, we want blonde kids. They had to reshoot the pilot with two blonde kids. And if you watch it now, it's blonde twins and a blonde girl, even though the parents are brunette.
I that stuff really bothers me, actually. I look at that stuff and I'm like, this family is impossible. Can you at least cast people so that the one that gets me every time is when they have two brown-eyed parents and they have like three kids and they're all blue-eyed. And I'm like, look, we all did those squares in, you know, high school biology. You can have one blue-eyed kid. I will accept one, but you got three blue-eyed kids? No. Please go back to casting.
No, it's again, and business is interesting. I like doing business work at some level, but I have to turn off my sort of super creative brain, like the training I have in entertainment. And you have to kind of turn off your super academic brain because they don't need to hear all this theory. It turns out they don't need to be taught, which bugs me.
It's like, can I share this really cool thing with you? And they're like, no, please don't do that.
No, we don't care that this came from the 12th century Gorgias. Yeah. Yep. Yeah, I get it. Yeah. Okay. So what are you looking for right now, as far as clients? Like, we have about 5 minutes. I don't want to take you too long. What kind of good people would come to your services?
So as far as Appendence and what we do, I go into companies and train employees in seminars. And so that's any company that's working on professional development are usually people who bring me in. Lots of government agencies, lots of banks, because I care about credibility. I've worked with engineers because they struggle to sound nice when they are writing things. Essentially, if you are using writing to build trust relationships with your clients and customers, then I can share strategies, techniques that will help your employees be more effective in that work. I can also make them faster, which people like. Faster saves money. And in addition to the seminars, I built an online course. It's a 6-week program where any employee, and most of the people that I work with are in that program, are people who, for whatever reason, they don't feel confident that their writing is getting the results that they want. So they're coming to me looking for, how can I make sure that when I am writing, I am showing that I am the best possible employee, presenting the best possible version of everything that we're doing? And we work for 6 weeks together. There's video exercise content on in the course. So you do that independently, try to integrate that with your job throughout the week. Then you send me writing that you did that week. I give you feedback on it and we meet on Mondays and talk about the concept and your writing and how you're integrating stuff. And then the next week you go through, try the next concept, add it on. And that program has been so amazing because in a day seminar, I can tell you a bunch of stuff. Like we're having this awesome conversation. This is what class is like. I tell people a bunch of stuff. I do my little show. I have no idea when I leave if you're actually going to be a better writer or not. I hope that you are, but I don't know. The 6-week online program that I built, I know because I can see and my clients can see, here's what you turned in at the beginning and here's what you turned in the end and look how awesome this is. So the impact that I'm having through that online course has been phenomenal. And very rewarding, right? So yeah.
Are you laying out like a set of principles or a set of exact tactics? Like, is that, how are you judging that they've made this progress?
Yes. So the 6 modules start with credibility. So I always start with just like, why are we doing this? Why do we care about this? And so the very first exercise is actually for them to take a message that they received during the week and tell me why they trust or don't trust that person. So back to that, try to separate the judgment from the evidence. What is the thing that's happening in the writing that's either helping you trust them or detracting from? Virtually everybody who works with me picks somebody who they don't trust, which is fun. So spam messages, very bizarre sales messages, things. So then I get examples for the next courses that I build.
Sure, yeah.
So they take those apart. Then we do planning. Planning is one of the things that makes people more effective. So I teach them 7 questions you can ask yourself before you write anything that actually have some neurological stuff, makes you more effective so that by the time you start writing, that's much easier than a lot of people who looking at a blank page is sort of scary. So 7 questions, they take 7 seconds once you learn them. So you're just like, do, 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 you're ready to go. So that's how I make people faster. Then we go through specific strategies, how to be complete and clear. So complete and clear, those are looking at your grammar, looking at your overall content. What are the things that you can do in order to ensure that you're sending people a whole message and one that they can understand? The next unit is the hardest. It's concise and considerate. So how do you write things that are short and nice? Because the shorter something is, the less nice it sounds.
Right.
But the longer something is, the less people read it. So we're really working for that ideal balance. And there are things grammatically that we can do. Simple things like asking a question, as I mentioned, instead of saying, I was wondering if, just ask, put the question mark. Things for conciseness. We start a lot of sentences. The beginning of the sentence is empty. Like, there are many reasons why we should do this. There are. Those 2 words are in the grammatically most important part of the sentence. The subject and the verb, there are, and you have told me nothing. So let's start using the parts of the sentence that we have to have to communicate effectively. So we do those kinds of exercises. The last 2, I do a lot of formatting. How can you arrange messages so that people will read them? What are some of the strategies we can use? I do some color theory. How do you use color to make people look at things in your email? And then lastly, we do proofreading. Nobody's good at it. Here are the things you need to practice in order to get better.
Nice. So you got modules. You're moduled.
Yep. 6 weeks. And each week you're doing one of those things, focusing on it, trying it out. And then each week you're kind of aggregating, right? So that the way I write the assignments, you're turning in whatever you wrote. But my assignment says, like, make sure you do this step and make sure you do this step and make sure you do this step. So each week it gets a little bit more. So that by the end, when I'm looking at the message and they're looking at it, they've built something that's entirely different than what they would have started with.
Well, I think that kind of modularized learning where you take it down to very specifics like that, where it's that sense of, my son taught himself how to do video editing and special effects completely from YouTube. And it was based on that concept, you know, the best kind of learning is point of need learning, that you can find the right answer instantly. And online, you can search until, you know, you have your set of instructors who give good answers And you, then you put it out to the general community and you get the right answer quick.
Yeah.
And he's learned that to the point where he has no patience for inefficient learning. He can't stand it. He couldn't stand sitting in high school. Mm. He's like, this is the worst way to learn I've ever seen.
Yeah.
And when you can break things down into modules like you've done, where it's very tied to here's a technique, think about it, try it, give you feedback, get it down, and then you've got that in your quiver. That seems like a better way of doing that kind of instruction.
Yeah. And then hopefully we'll build some more courses so that people can keep practicing and building on those skills. So that's a goal. But our next session starts September 13th and they run every 6 to 8 weeks.
Okay. Well, I'm not sure when this will be up and out, but if it's up before September,
you can 13th. Cut that part out if you want.
Come back. Yeah. Go back and take the course in the past. But cool. Yeah. I don't know. I'm such a geek about words. It's so much fun to talk to somebody that's also co-geeky.
Yes.
About it. And you found your own niche. Like, I've done a bunch of business writing and I've done tons of different types of writing jobs over the years, but they've gotten to the point where I get so bored with it because it is so structured and it's so much work. You know, it's not always tedious, but it is, you have to pay attention to every little thing in writing. You can't make mistakes the way you can in podcast conversations and even in stand-up clubs where you make a mistake. So what? You come back and you fix it. Like, verbal has a lot of erasure to it.
Yes. Whereas
writing has this permanence that's going to show your mistake forever.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That criteria, I'm like, I don't want to work my language that hard. I want to have more fun with it, you know?
I think there's a lot of flexibility for us, but you want to be aware of the things that make or break your relationships, because that writing is going to be there forever and people can go back to it. We have that idea now with video and audio recordings, right? People can backtrack and they can listen to your error over and over. But because spoken language has historically been, I say ephemeral, but you're right, like this erasure, we just don't have the same expectation. We're more forgiving. And so, yeah, you can rewind and listen to me flub my words or whatever happened, right? And nobody's going to be like, and now I don't trust you. But you have one spelling error in an email and people are like, spam.
How dare you?
Or you spell somebody's name wrong. They're like, that's it. I'm going to find somebody else to work with.
Yeah. Yeah, the criteria we have for that stuff. And then yet they don't apply the same criteria because writing is hard. It takes super focus. It takes micro, you know, the ability to look at the micros of language and to check against all these rules, check against how you said it earlier versus how you're going to say it at the end, yeah. All that stuff. So there's so much mental work going on in it. I was a journalism undergraduate, journalism in English, and I liked the creative writing stuff because I could always make professors laugh. So there was always enough creativity there that they would reward me. But the journalism is so strict. You know, and they would just be like, you've made the, and I'm like, you're killing me. I can't do this anymore. I don't want to work that hard. Same reason I got out of physics. I was a mechanical engineer. I'm like, I'm not going to work this hard, like to get all my problems correct.
I took physics so that I could get a free trip to the Six Flags, but I understood none of it.
So I admire you. I admire you staying in the writing. Good job. Good.
I think it's really fun. I hope I get to do it for a long time.
Nice. Well, I appreciate it very much. Everybody jump over there and check out Appendance.
Appendance. Yep. Appendance.com. Our courses are at online.appendance.com.
But you're losing dance. Such a good word. Dance. Appendance.
I know, but it's just how it rolls off the tongue. Appendance.
Mm-hmm. It does, except nobody's ever used that word in spoken language in all of history.
No, they have not, but that's what made it a good company name. It doesn't have any other association.
Yeah, I like when names at least create a cognitive intrigue. You know, to me, I have a whole criteria for what I really like in names. And that one, if people go, what?
Yep.
Then I'm like, they're involved. That's what all I need.
Yeah. Well,
that means they're going to go and research it a little bit more. So it penetrates a little more deeply into the cerebral cortex. And you win with that name once you've done
that. People are interested. Yes.
Yeah.
That's the hope. All right.
Well, cool. This has been Rhetoric Warriors Podcast. Thanks for coming. Get out there and persuade some people. They always need it.